Welcome back to BSA by Design, a podcast about transforming healthcare, educational, and research facilities through expert design and insight. I'm your host, Brian Moore, and thank you for joining us again. I'm excited to share this episode, our first roundtable with some of our key client-facing principals, talking about how they keep the client's best interests at the forefront of customer service, ethical considerations, and having difficult conversations with clients. In this episode, I am joined by BSA CEO Tim Spence, President Sam Jackson, Learning and Discovery Practice Director Scott Allen, and Principals Jane Everett, Kat DiPietro, and Craig Puccetti. First, let me introduce our guests. Tim Spence is the CEO of BSA Life Structures and graduated from the University of Southern California with a Bachelor of Architecture degree. He holds several licenses and certifications, including AIA, FACHA, and NCARB. Sam Jackson is the president of BSA and graduated from Rolls-Hulman Institute of Technology with a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering. He also earned his MBA from Indiana University's Kelley School of Business. Sam has worked at BSA his entire career, holding a number of positions, including principal, director of engineering, and chief operations officer. Scott Allen is an architect and learning and discovery practice director here at BSA. He earned his bachelor's degree in architecture from Virginia Tech. Jane Everett is a principal at BSA, an architect with several licenses and certifications, including AIA, ACHA, and is a Lean Six Sigma Yellow Belt. Jane has been with BSA for nearly 25 years and graduated from Arizona State University with a Master's of Architecture in 1999 and has a BBA in Economics from St. Norbert College. She's also the Indianapolis Studio Director. Kat DiPietro is a principal at BSA, a healthcare architect, a Lean Six Sigma Yellow Belt, and a graduate from the University of Colorado at Boulder with a bachelor's degree in environmental design and a Master of Architecture and Planning from the University of Colorado at Denver. She is also the Denver Studio Director. And finally, Craig Puccetti is a principal and healthcare architect with ACHA and EDAC certifications. He graduated from Texas A&M with a Bachelor of Environmental Design. Craig is also the Austin Studio Director. Now, on to our conversation. Thanks to all of you for joining me on this roundtable discussion. I wanted to frame this conversation into some buckets, fire some prompts at you, and then let you all chime in. So first, let's start with this one, a client-centric approach. And Jane, I want to start with you. You're working on one of the largest hospital projects taking place in the country right now at Indiana University Health's new downtown Indianapolis Hospital. How do you define and prioritize the client's best interests in your daily work?
So in my opinion, as we go through any project, defining and prioritizing the client's best interest is the foundational to any, in any context. The most important element is understanding their overarching goals for the project. And to me, that's imperative to the success of the project. Part of that is being an active listener, understanding and communicating with the client, asking some probing questions so that we fully understand what their needs are and what they're wanting to achieve. On our current project, our client had established their guiding principles right up front. So in the very beginning of this project, we knew what we were striving for, and we've used those to help us make design decisions all along the way. We've use those guiding principles in all of the user group meetings that we've facilitated so that the users are very well aware of what we're designing towards, what we're hoping to achieve. And we've referred back to those so that they help to inform all of the decisions that we're making and just use those as a foundation to help guide the team in that decision-making process. We're also in a unique position here because our design team is on site on a daily basis. So we're working in the same building as our client. So we see the development of the project every day, not only in design, but also in the built form as it's being constructed right outside our windows. But it's really a unique position to be in. And we have the client kind of in the forefront of our mind at all times, trying to meet the needs and the goals of the client.
Literally, because you're right there, right?
Literally, yes.
Is that the first project that you've worked on? And has anybody else worked on one where you've been on site for this long period of time?
Yes, that we're here here with the client. I mean, I see them just walking in the halls, right? So it's, you know, we can have a conversation at the coffee maker that might lead to something else and help us in our decision-making or the designs that we're doing. So it's a very different position than we typically are in as we're doing this. It's exciting and nerve-wracking all in the same breath. So,
Scott, I want to turn to you. You're in a different market than healing. How does the higher education, learning, and discovery market compare prioritizing clients' best interests from day to day as kind of a comparison to what Jane just discussed? Or is there similarities?
Yeah, no, there's a lot of similarities, as you might imagine, Brian, right? Of course. But higher ed, I'll start with that. And really, you know, it focuses a lot on student success, absolutely first. And almost everything that we do and decisions that we make is really based around student success. We've also seen really decisions be made in a much more holistic way because we're looking at the school and the schools are looking at how the impact is for the student. So then the idea is it a live, learn, and play situation for them? How do they interact with each other? How do they find places for wellness? How do they find places for respite? They want to find places for collaboration. They want to find places that are flexible for them. And so oftentimes that is a part of almost every project that we do, whether it be a classroom space, to laboratory space, to anything else. And the discovery avenue on that in a similar way, it's really about trying to figure out ideas and opportunities for innovation, flexibility, and really kind of exploration to take place within that. And so that's really where we focus on those aspects of it. But just as Jane said, it's really foundational to figure out those things that drive each of the projects in a very specific way. But holistically, that's what we see in both the learning and discovery markets throughout.
Tim, I'm going to pivot to you. How do you balance short-term requirements with long-term best interests? So, you know, sometimes it seems like those things can collide, especially when you're looking at maybe a master plan versus a particular project. How do you deal with that when you're working with a client?
I mean, I think the reality is that we have to do both. And I think design professionals, and especially architects, they're really adept at challenges from both a micro and a macro level, and that allows us to address both short-term needs and long-term goals. Now, I think one of the things that's interesting, Brian, is in real life, it's much more nuanced than that simple binary solution. So there are some tools that we use. We utilize guiding principles. Jane talked a little bit about that. I've utilized conditions of satisfaction, choosing by advantages, to arrive at optimal solutions for each specific client and project. And I want to highlight that because it's not a one size fits all. You really have to, as Jane talked about, you have to tailor this to your client. And just to explain a little bit, she explained about guiding principles, but conditions of satisfaction, they're specific and measurable criteria that define when a project's requirements or deliverable is considered complete and satisfactory. And oftentimes you set those up at the beginning of the job so that you know what you're solving. And then choosing by advantages is a lean tool. It's an objective design decision-making tool that determines the best decision by looking at advantages of each option. So again, solving both that micro and macro, we have to do both, and there's some great tools for it.
Sam, I wanted to ask you, because I've heard you make some internal comments to our teams about this as well. Do you have some additional thoughts?
So I've not been part of a project where the entire project team is on site daily, like Jane's IU Health project, but I've been part of some larger projects that are expansion renovation type projects. And as the principal and or PM, I've been on site 1-2 days a week for an extended period of time. So much so that, you know, I've spent more time sometimes with the clients and with, you know, my own project team or certainly coworkers and things. And VSA has always been a client focused firm. And so it's a matter of taking advantage of your time on site to not just do the work and be present, but to get to know the client and the individuals at the client's side. And there may be like one decision maker or an executive team, but the larger the project is, the more stakeholders, the more people with opinions and skin in the game. So the more you get to know them, better off everything is and you are and the ability to perform for that client. And sometimes it does take a little bit of diplomacy, right? When there's disagreement on the client side and how to create some consensus and know how to move forward. And if bad news has to be shared, who's going to share it, how and when and why. And it's easy to stub your toe and say the wrong thing at the wrong time, but it takes a lot of work to really stay in front of that and make sure everybody on the client side is aware of what's going on. And through that process, you really get a sense of what the long-term goals are for the client, what's really important for the client, people really get upset about, what they really care about. And hopefully they're living their own values and they're living their own mission. But sometimes you can get a sense of where you need to be careful and walk the line. And it's all based on the people.
Scott, again, I'm curious how this looks for you at a learning and discovery level. So is all this tracking as well in terms of balancing long-term and short-term needs, or does it look a little different?
No, it's very similar as we talked about before, Brian. I would say, though, one of the things that we deal with, and everybody deals with on projects, but it's really prevalent in higher education, is we really have finite budgets oftentimes. They're allocated by state and public entities, and so the projects are really driven in that way. And so we work with them quite often to figure out what we can do to create flexibility for what they need in their current challenges and to what they need for their long-term needs. So we like to talk about the idea of long life, loose fit, so that adaptability and that flexibility sits out there for them, and really trying to look at what we can do to create what they need right now and what they can have for the future. And that goes across the spectrum. That's for classroom spaces, to student spaces, to laboratory and learning spaces that might be out there. Really looking for how that flexibility sits out there for longer use, because their buildings are ones that they want to be out there for 50 or 100 years, right, on those campuses.
Does anyone have an example that they would like to share of a situation where you had to make tough decisions to protect the client's best interests? And just tell us a little bit what that was like. And you don't have to call out anybody in specific, but if there's an example, I'd love to hear a few.
So yeah, I wanted to share a recent example, because often we get crunched by schedule when we're waiting for one of our clients to get the funding that they had lined up. And we know it's coming, so we just don't know that exact timing. And we just heard last week on a project up at Cheyenne, and we had to adapt our resources pretty quickly in this project, because we know that it's mission critical for them to get this funding. We also know that our team has to move much more quickly. So instead of shortening our design schedule, we decided to work closely with our design build partner and really overlap that design schedule with our bidding process. So that way we can get, you know, what the leadership needs early enough so they can encumber those funds. And so we needed to have those resources ready. So we had planned ahead for this timing, but we also needed to work closely and get creative to make this something that they can feel confident in, that we're not rushing the process. We're not, you know, trying to cut things off in the process, but we're working together to make it happen.
It seems like many times the tough decisions come in the form of of code licensing requirements. And, you know, many times we're brought in the projects and they think it's as simple as we're just going to do a diagnostic imaging room or something like that. And you get into the department and you realize nothing has really been done in the department for a really long time. So you get in a situation of having to advise a client of, you know, some gross deficiencies potentially. They had only budgeted one, you know, diagnostic imaging room or, you know, a group of three, and they really need to renovate 20 more thousand square feet and upgrade electrical systems and gas. All the bad news you can tend to bring to clients. So, you know, the tough decision sometimes is just bringing to the clients is a partnership, the reality of the situation that we're experts. And sometimes we have to inform them of things they don't want to hear in terms of, you know, potentially their project is going to need more scope. Ideally, they've engaged us early on and we've vetted that scope, but sometimes they bring the project to us and then we determine there's a problem. So the last thing you want to do is leave an existing condition alone and then have a risk to patient safety or have a licensure or accreditation issue. So, you know, as partners with our client, we really are there to advise them and just keep them out of hot water.
What's the response usually been when you do that, Craig?
It's well received typically, in terms of they want to know the reality. Many times they'll question it. Sometimes, you know, some people know better than architects, as we've all experienced. And so you really have to bring them to the table with the health department, I found, at least some of the stakeholder side and the project management side, to make sure everyone understands the gravity of the situation. But I think generally speaking, there's an appreciation for that expertise. The last thing you want to find out is that you have a problem is when you have a licensure failure or accreditation failure, and then you end up potentially with the risk of shutting your facility down or having operations that are revenue generating. You know, we can really help keep that from happening.
Jane, I want to circle back to you and the large project again that you're currently working on and any others that might come to mind with this. But how do you handle difficult conversations, kind of like what Craig was talking about, or deliver not so great news while keeping the client's best interest in mind?
It's not usually the fun part of the job, right? So not something that we look forward to, but it happens and just need to handle it in a professional way. In my opinion, it requires preparation. So it's not something to just jump into. You need to think about how the message is going to be delivered, but also how the client may react to whatever the situation might be, what kind of questions they might be asking, and be prepared in some regards. You know, think about what your response might be and not just jump into something. You need to kind of formulate, you know, how the conversation might go ahead of time. Be prepared. There will always be something that pops up that you haven't thought about, as usual. But I also think it's very important to be transparent. Just be very clear. Don't try to like sugarcoat anything. You know, just tell them like it is. Tell them the facts. Don't omit important details. And just, you know, put it out there, whatever the topic might be. But then don't dwell on the negative aspect of it. Be prepared with some potential solutions or alternatives, some way to help resolve the situation. And then just, I think the most important thing after the conversation has all been said is really just to follow up with the client also to make sure that we show them that, you know, this is at the forefront of our minds, and we're committed to addressing the issue, helping them to resolve it in the best way possible, and just deal with it as a team and be their partner in the resolution.
Yeah, I'm hearing a lot of BSA core values pop up throughout there, right? Being ideal team players and partners and communication. And I'm assuming, you know, the stronger relationship that you have with the client, as like you said, it's not very fun, but you already are anticipating kind of what the reactions are going to be, and you can customize your approach that way, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Scott, I'm going to come back to you again because these are just different markets, right? So how do you handle difficult conversations in a higher ed, you know, kind of discovery level?
Yeah, it's very similar to what Jane described. And I think it also really goes back to the foundational conversation that Sam was talking about earlier, right, with your clients, right? It's about the relationship you build with them. Hopefully there's a lot of trust that's there. So the conversation is one that's based on just a normal dialogue. And you know, Jane mentioned the idea of being a partner. If you come at it from that perspective and you talk about very directly sort of the challenge that's there and try to be a problem solver with them, that's a really big part of it. Oftentimes in all of our institutional work that we do in all three of our markets, there's many people that are involved in these decisions. And so hopefully you have a small conversation about the challenge first with a smaller group, kind of come to a way to kind of approach that. And if it has to go to a larger group, then you do it together. And I think the biggest part about that is you do it together. You solve it together. You address it together. You're in it together. And, you know, Jane was absolutely correct. The idea of being very, very transparent and honest about it from the beginning and then coming with some options is really one of the biggest aspects to being successful in that conversation. It's never easy.
Biggest takeaway I heard there was doing it together as a team. That builds a lot of camaraderie. I've got an open-ended one. Anybody can answer this. Can you discuss an instance where effective communication helped resolve a conflict or a misunderstanding, maybe with a client?
This is a recent issue we encountered. And as Jane said earlier, that sometimes communicating tough things is not super fun. And we recently had a staffing challenge on a project. And you know, I think when you go through things like that, I think transparency is paramount. We immediately scheduled a video call, which I say video call because it's important for people to see you and that, you know, there's body language that's involved in that. And during the call, we acknowledged that there had been shortcomings on our part. And I think that's an important piece, is just to get honesty on the table. And we reaffirmed our commitment to delivering a successful project. We then presented a clear plan to address the staffing issue and, you know, outlined a little bit of a regular schedule of communication to keep the client informed on our progress. And so there was, it wasn't meant as kind of a one touch and we're done. It was meant as a, here's how we're looking to solve it. And we're actually going to touch base with you on a semi-regular basis to make sure that you're happy, to make sure that we're meeting our commitments, to make sure that in the end you get the product that you paid for.
Ryan, I think for me, all of what I've heard in all those messages, which I agree with, all of the hard news and hard conversations are easier to deliver when you do it with respect to the client and their goals and putting the client first. And a lot of those, you know, you're taking it back to what ultimately they want, whether it's a schedule or a budget or some quality standards or what their goals are. And I think they're always more perceptive or receptive, I guess, to the message and to the truth when it's delivered in context of, hey, we're trying to help you through this process, even though we've got some bad news to deliver. And as long as they don't get a sense that it's, you know, like self-serving on our part, it's a, it goes usually goes a little bit easier.
Let's move to our third bucket, ethical considerations. And I'd like to hear from Tim as our CEO first. What ethical principles or guidelines BSA follows to ensure we're acting with, again, those clients' best interests at heart?
Yeah, I really love this question a lot, Brian. And it's because trust is one of the most precious and delicate things a client can give us. And it takes a super long time to develop that. It can be destroyed and matter of minutes. And if I had to define BSA's code of ethics, the following words would be included on that. And one is disrespect. It kind of gets back to appreciating others for who they are and giving them a seat at the table, both in the, you know, formally, but also like just the way you treat people. People know when their ideas are heard, and that's really what it comes down to, that you matter, your ideas matter. Number two, I would say client focus. And I think, Sam, you were kind of talking a little bit about this, that it fundamentally gets down to like when the owner wins, we win type of attitude. And we're not satisfied with anything less. The third thing I would say is honesty and transparency. We've been talking about that. Do the right thing, even if it hurts. And sometimes it hurts. And then the fourth thing is integrity. And the thing I like about integrity is sometimes it's not shown, it's shown differently, or it's uncovered by different circumstances. So it's easy to have integrity when times are great. It's a little bit more difficult to have integrity when times are not so great. And I think the word of integrity implies that you're behaving consistently in line with your standards and your values. And that's why we talk so much about values here at BSA, Brian.
And I'm going to pivot then off of that and ask Sam, how do you navigate a situation maybe where your client's interests may conflict with BSA's interests?
Yeah, that's tough. So ultimately, we do a lot of, I think, due diligence and research with our clients before we, hopefully, and we know what we're getting into when we start that relationship. We've got a robust go, no-go process that ideally when we really know the client, we're checking all the boxes and we're having all the right conversations, we avoid all of the ethical issues, all the conflicts of interest and all of those things. When they do arise, you just got to, again, go back and have a honest conversation with where we're at. And there's been times in the past where clients have, for one reason or other, good clients, perfectly good clients, have asked us to do something that we didn't feel quite right about. And so the way we've handled that, and nothing like egregious, we would never do anything over the top, but even the fine line, right? Like when perfection's your standard, anything short of that, we'll just write a letter to the client that says, hey, professionally, you can do this. We recommend you don't do this. Here's why. And then if it's too far, we'll waive liability or responsibility or whatever. And we've never gotten to the point, I don't think, where we've had to take like legal measures. But again, we work with clients who are above board, who make good decisions, who have the right things in mind. And sometimes it does come with a hard conversation, but they'll make the right decision at the end of the day. And if we got a client who we feel historically doesn't, we just stop working with that client and we walk away.
Scott, have you had similar situations in the higher education discovery area in terms of conflict of interest between the client and the firm?
I've seen it, Brian, as well. And it is definitely something that we encounter. I think the biggest thing is, as Sam talked quite a bit about, right, is the shared core values between not only ourselves and at BSA, but also our clients. And using that as a way to kind of address the situation, hopefully. There are times, though, where that isn't possible. There was a project I worked on many years ago out in California where we got into an instance where a client was unwilling to yield on something they were should and had to, as a requirement, address. And we actually ended up walking away from the project because of that. It was a painful decision for the firm. It was a painful decision on the project, but it was a really important part of what we do, right? I mean, holding on to our values, holding on to our core, and really kind of working within what our responsibilities are with our licenses as well, right? We have a responsibility that sits out there in that too, and the standard of care that we provide. And so, you know, you try to have that conversation, you hopefully come to the conclusion that we'd like to see that's shared as a team, but that doesn't always happen.
That's a good point about the responsibility for sure. This next question, kind of similar, but it's for Jane, Craig, and Kat. Have you encountered any ethical dilemmas or gray areas when you've been serving a client in your roles? And perhaps most importantly, how did you resolve them?
Yeah, actually, it's kind of along the same lines of what kind of Sam was outlining in terms of client alignment and having the right fit. But it comes down to, you know, situation where you have a client maybe asked, you have a deficiency, and then you're required to correct the deficiency. And sometimes the client doesn't always agree with, oh, that health department inspector doesn't know what they're talking about. And many times we'll go back and we have a disagreement, right, sometimes with what they say. And we go back with our reasoning behind why we believe it to be the existing design acceptable. Sometimes we win, many times we lose. But the client doesn't always, times when they're not completely in alignment with us, doesn't always want to make those changes. We provide a plan of correction that outlines the changes, saying we're going to do the changes. And many times our signatures go on that. And so, you know, it's hard to do that sometimes if you're pressured to turn a blind eye. But, you know, as a trusted partner, we got to demonstrate our integrity and follow through and make sure those items are followed through with. So everything's properly represented. And ultimately, the correction, whether we like it or not, is actually implemented into the project.
Yeah. So for this one, I mean, I appreciate what Sam and Craig have both shared about the go, no-go process, because sometimes we've been in a client relationship, Brian, for quite a long time. And then we're working on some work that, you know, we haven't been a part of all those changes and conversations around the relationship. And sometimes that leadership changes for that client, right? So as we're looking at some of our current clients and some of those relationships, I remember recently a conversation with Tim on the phone, and he said, we're going to do what's right. And I just, you know, that really sticks out in my mind, knowing that integrity is different when you're in tough situations, when you find something in the wall you didn't expect. So anytime we come up against the ethical challenge, there's often money on the line. It's often a tight budget or low contingency or no contingency. And so I think it's important in these conversations to remember our values, remember what is right to us in our go, no-go process, what is right for the client's interest, for our team's interest, how can we balance both? And so I think it's a dialogue. I don't think it's very cut and dry every time. And I think that dialogue has to, again, respect our partners, respect their point of view and where they're coming from, and also to make sure, you know, we're meeting everyone's interests at the table and keeping that dialogue open as we go.
Oh, that's great. And you kind of led perfectly into my next question for Tim, which is, how does BSA foster an ethical culture that prioritizes clients' best interests?
I think that's a great follow-up question to the ethics one earlier, and just follow on what Kat is talking about here, is it really gets back down to the foundation of who we are. And that, to me, that's mission, vision, and values. And let me just explain a little bit, because it's easy to go to those buzzwords and just say it's our mission, vision, and values. But we have a people-centric mission, and it says to improve lives. It clearly places the focus on the positive impact for people. Yes, we want to make a profit, but not at the expense of people. And so it's people-centric. And I think because of that, we treat our clients differently. We approach them differently. And then our vision is partnership-driven. Our vision emphasizes collaboration with clients and creating a culture of empowerment and fostering those shared successes. So it's a partnership. And I don't think we ever envision ourselves as the Lone Ranger. It's this group of people that are working for the best. And then finally, the values, and there's been a lot of discussion already on this podcast and in past podcasts about our core values. We talk about them a lot, being partners and purposeful learners, owners, and ideal team players. That really translates into concrete action that benefits the client. I like what Kat said, because I feel the responsibility that ethics starts at the top. And as leaders at BSA, we hold ourselves to a higher standard. Doesn't mean we're perfect, but we hold ourselves to that standard. We strive to make ethical decisions every day. We're transparent when mistakes happen, and we take full responsibility, and we make the necessary corrections to ensure it doesn't happen again. And this, it really sets the tone for the entire organization, Brian. And I think that's on us as leaders. And by leaders, I mean everyone on the phone here, everyone on this podcast is a leader. You have an impact. You have a weight in the organization.
That's a great bow on that section. So for our last bucket, I just have a few more questions, and I want to talk about continuous improvement. So I'll start with Sam. How do you gather feedback from clients to understand if you're meeting their needs effectively?
Yeah, that's really done in two ways. One is just through the principal's interactions with the clients. And ideally, they've got a deep enough relationship that they're having those honest conversations. And there's the periodic, I don't care if it's coffee or lunch or a dinner, just to say, hey, how's the project going? How's the team doing? Any complaints, any improvements we can make? We're on schedule, on budget, all that kind of stuff. On top of that, we've also sent out surveys to the clients at key milestones, at deliverable milestones for the project, and solicit comments, feedback. And it's just a quick, how are we doing, rate the team kind of thing. So we do it in a couple of different ways. Our principals are accountable for client satisfaction and project outcomes. They should be taking the onus on themselves to really make sure that the team's delivering on and meeting the client's expectations. Our brand, our reputation has always been built on exceptional quality of documentation and excellent client service. And we've maintained that culture through the years and really, you know, promote and reward people for the ability to do that.
While you were talking about some of that, I thought of this question for you, Jane. How can the team, and especially because you're, as we all see you in the screen right now, you're on the project site, like you mentioned earlier, how can the team collaborate to share best practices on a project to better serve the client's interests?
Yeah, I think on every project, communication and collaboration are key to the success. It doesn't matter the scale or the size of the project, you need to communicate within your team. And so specifically on this project, we've established a cadence of team meetings. There's a lot of information that comes flowing through our team and a lot of people that need to hear the message. And so we've used a couple different ways to communicate that. One just being in-person meetings. Others, we've used different softwares in order to establish all the information, gather it, and organize it. So that has really helped the team. The one key factor is the way that we've organized our team, and given that we have floor leads. So given that we have a multitude of stories, multiple story building, we have one person who is kind of the owner of a floor, so that we have consistency throughout the building. And as Sam mentioned, you know, we've always prided ourselves on the documentation the documents, I'm sorry, that we put out and the quality of our documents. And that's, I mean, it's no different on any project. And here we really want to see the consistency in the design of the building, as well as the documents and how we're documenting that whole building. So our floor leads have regular communication. A lot of it is informal, but they're talking with each other, sharing what they've learned, either through a user group meeting or different details that we're using in the project or softwares that have really enhanced things and made things a little bit easier and more efficient for our process. So it's worked, you know, through all disciplines, that cross communication. We've also, fortunately, we've done several projects for this client. So we have other lessons learned from previous projects that we've been able to look back on and improve upon, or know some of the standards. We kind of have a feeling for what the owner wants because of other things that we've done previously. So that's really important to really create that library. And that's what we're trying to do on this project, is create things that we can move forward with future projects for this client and as well as other clients. But then lastly, I think regardless of the length of time of a project, it's really important to celebrate the successes along the way. And so as we've had different milestones that we've met, we've celebrated each one of those, each of the design packages that have gone out, when they started construction, you know, different things. Even though we're still on design, there's so many other things to be celebrated as we move forward. Not just the conclusion of something, but the whole progression of the project is really important for everyone to feel like they're a part of it and know that the success of this project will be seen by, you know, us and the client. And it's really about a full collaborative team effort between all of the disciplines and the owner.
It's really important when you've got a project that can be years long, right? Celebrating those little milestones for sure. Okay, so last question for each of you, and you can answer in any order. And if you don't have an answer, that's totally fine as well. In each of your roles, how do you continuously improve in order to keep that client-centric approach from project to project? So kind of building off of what Jane just said, carrying things over from one project to another or within a client, what are those overarching things that you've learned in your careers on this topic?
I can go on this. I'm going to sound like the old guy in the room, but you know, going back, I think for me, it was in high school. I worked in the food industry, and I would just say, for any young person kind of coming up, it's a great place to start, because it teaches you how to provide exceptional customer service and how to exceed expectations. And I learned very early what it took to keep somebody happy and loyal, and that it really translates into a professional setting. And I wholeheartedly agree. There's been some great sayings that have come out of our 50 years. One of our founders had this saying, and hopefully I don't butcher it, but he said something like, take care of the customer and they'll take care of the firm. And it's a really simple but powerful principle, which it means by prioritizing their success, we build that long-term relationship and we build trust. And I think our track record speaks for itself. We've enjoyed a ton of repeat clients over the years. In fact, the client that Jane is talking about is one of our earliest clients that's been with us for over 50 years. So I think that, again, speaks for itself.
One of the things we've learned, and I think Kat and I can both relate to this, learn from the past, you know, especially when you have larger teams and they span multiple projects. Can't just keep asking the same question. Have that kind of what I call a living playbook that documents the decisions. And then we continue to build on for clients. And then we avoid any frustration or, you know, with the clients saying, well, I've answered that 10 times. And new players can come into projects and have all the information, the most current information at their fingertips. I think that's important. Make them feel like they are the only client. I mean, and to Tim's point, I'm all about exceeding expectations, our teams exceeding expectations. I think that's important. Recognize that one size does not fit all, and you have to have your ability. We have great tools, but have the ability to flex those tools. And then make sure you've got the right people in place to deliver the projects, ones that have the appropriate skill set, the right depth of bench, and then, you know, that compatibility with the client as well. And then pretty much reiterating what we've said a million times about over communication, you know, communicate
be responsive, be a trusted resource, but to be that, make yourself available so they can get you when they need you. And then avoid those surprises that we all talk about. Give those hard truths in a timely manner, help the clients guide their decision-making process and any maybe detour they might need to make along the way.
I agree with that. And I'll add that the ideas that I've learned are simple, but take a lot of effort to implement. And it's simply this, that every project has a set of goals that are defined by the scope, schedule, and budget. And if you can keep whoever on the ownership side is in charge of that happy with the progress of the scope, schedule, budget, they're usually pretty happy with the deliverable, right? It's facilitated through, it can be just informal weekly or biweekly conversations of, hey, here's the progress we've made last week. Here's what we need from you next week. Here's open questions. Here's where it's at risk, all those things. And it's just that continuous, that's the effort you put into it, right? It's those continuous conversations. So everybody knows where we're at and can solve, issues real time. Clients hate being surprised, by bad news. So the more you can talk and keep everything above board, even the bad news is like, well, we'll work through it, right? So it's just the ability to keep those things, on pace and on track and hopefully ahead of schedule and under budget, and we'll get through it. Brian, I had one global final thought, and it's simply that, listening through all this and contemplating ethical issues and how to deal with those, it makes me really appreciate how incredibly blessed we are in dealing mostly with healthcare and hospitals and higher education universities. Our clients also answer to accrediting boards, licensing boards, inspectors and all this. And they are as driven to excellence as we are. So it is really easy for us to find a client base where we don't have to deal with ethical issues, right? None of our clients are trying to cut corners or, get out of the ground and ignore any requirements or jurisdictional issues. So a lot of these things are just naturally not issues for us. And when they are issues, that, again, the clients want to take care of them as ethically as we do. So it's a real blessing that, there's a lot of things that we don't have to deal with that I know other industries probably do.
That's an excellent point, Sam, and a perfect way to end this. Well, I want to thank each of you for joining me on this first roundtable. This was a nice experiment that we've tried here, and I think it went really well, a very robust conversation. So,
wow, what a fantastic discussion around the client's best interest. I'd like to thank Tim, Sam, Scott, Kat, Jane, and Craig for joining us on this episode of BSA by Design. If you're interested in learning more about how BSA Life Structures can best serve you, we encourage you to visit our website at bsalifestructures.com. There's a link in the show notes to contact us for more information. And be sure to subscribe to BSA by Design on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music so you don't miss an episode. We've got more content to share on our website and social media, so be sure to follow us on LinkedIn, YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and X. That's going to do it for this episode. Join us again next time on BSA by Design.